welcome to this session of Parley at the Hindu. This week, we are speaking about the question of returnees from the Islamic State. It's a debate that's been sparked by the Hindu's own report on four Kerala women who had traveled to Afghanistan sometime between 2016 and 2018 to join the Islamic State Khorasan, the ISIS's wing there. Afghan authorities want to return these women to India, but the government has given no response. As sources say, security agencies have actually advised against taking them back, given the risk as well as the radicalization factor. What are the international ramifications and the legalities around ISIS returnees, as well as what other countries are doing in these matters? With me, former diplomat, author and professor at the Indian Society of International Law, K.P. Fabian, and Kabir Taneja. He's a fellow of the Strategic Studies Program at the Observer Research Foundation. He's also the author of The ISIS Peril, the world's most feared terror group and its shadow on South Asia. Ambassador Fabian, if I could start with you, you've argued that no matter what the crime, the Indian government must take back these four women named Aisha, Rafaela, Mariam, and Nimisha or Fatima, as well as their children. Tell us why.
A couple of reasons. Thank you, Suhasini. One is that under the IPC, Indian Penal Code, Section 3, any citizen of India can be tried in India for any offense committed in India, abroad, or even in outer space. Okay, so that's point number one. Second thing is that we hear from media reports, not yet contradicted by the government. In fact, media reports carried by 3-4 media were identical in substance. So obviously, they might have been briefed by the same person in the government that says that Afghanistan wanted to deport them and that India has refused. And it was also said that India wants Afghanistan to try them. And one more cause has been adduced, that is, they will be such a grave threat to India's security. Now, in plain English, that is rubbish, because these four women, if they are coming back to India, they will be coming back in the custody of our security forces, and they can be put to court, and they can be held under custody till the court gives a verdict. Now, while in custody, they cannot be of any threat to the security of India. And the last reason, they have their families here. Now, let me ask you, Suhasini, when these reports came out, did the government of India take the trouble to advise the families in Kerala, listen, either these reports are true or they are not true? And also, as you know, in this particular case, Nimisha, I think her name,
yes,
her mother Bindu was on Asianet, and she also said that there is a granddaughter who is 4 years old. Now, what crime has she committed? Isn't it sensible for that child to be with the grandparents if the parents are not able to look after her? So there is no reason for India standing in the way of their return when Afghanistan asked for it.
Can I quickly ask you really, what are the legalities around the citizenship? Because some have argued, and of course, most of this debate is being held on social media, because as you pointed out, the government has not on the record actually said what it plans to do. Even according to the story the Hindu did, the Afghan government does not yet know what the Indian government plans to do when it comes to the case of these women. But the question some are asking is that if these women left India of their own volition and joined what they believed was an Islamic caliphate, pledged allegiance to this separate caliphate, to a separate country, don't they in fact lose their right to an Indian citizenship by acquiring this other notional citizenship?
No. The right to Indian citizenship you cannot take away from anyone. There are international treaties which say that, you know, you cannot strip anyone of citizenship and make that person stateless. Let me draw your attention to Shamima Begum. a UK citizen who left UK at 15, if you remember. And then after the Islamic State fell, the UK government said she cannot return and they stripped her of her citizenship. And the Court of Appeal in UK said the government was in the wrong. Then the government went to the Supreme Court and said there are national security reasons for the decision not to let her in. Well, national security reasons for not letting a girl of probably she's 21, for letting her into England? Come on, there is something wrong with it. But the Supreme Court said that, well, she can contest the decision about the stripping of citizenship, but when she's in a position to do so. So you could see that how legally convoluted was the position taken by UK.
All right.
And don't forget, Sukhasini, look at the passport which we are all carrying. Let me read it out to you. These are to request and require in the name of the President of India, of the Republic of India, all those whom it may concern to allow the bearer to pass freely without let or hindrance and to afford him or her every assistance and protection of which he or she may stand in need. Now, the passport, you know, enables you to go out. Of course, you also need a visa or an agreement that there is no need for visa. Now, the same passport permits you to come back without a visa.
Okay, so you're saying that there is no legal case under which the government can actually bar them from returning. Kabir Taneja, what about the national security question? Is there a national security or otherwise a risk from bringing back people who have been radicalized, who have been associated with a terror group, and who have possibly been involved in some kind of terror attack in other countries? Is there a threat in bringing them back?
Thanks, Suhasini. I don't think there is like a threat in bringing them back. But the question that arises, and I think the question that even the state would like a concrete answer to, is what do you do with them, right? And of course, it's very easy to say, you know, they can go through the process in India through the courts, and because, for example, the Islamic State is a banned organization in India, and whatever whatever the outcome of those trials are, you go through it basically. Now the problem here arises is, of course, that's a process that can be initiated and so on and so forth. But how do you estimate a person's radicalization, right? So we have seen this this argument play out time and time again, in not just in India, in Europe and the US and Canada, and so many places that have or are experiencing this whole phenomenon of the foreign fighters, so to speak. For example, in the UK, they have robust de-radicalization programs, and some of these people who have gone through these programs have come out after passing it officially and then conducted acts of terror as well, while after getting a certification of sorts from these government-funded programs that, okay, fine, they have been quote-unquote de-radicalized. So there are a lot of like questions that arise as far as national security goes. Of course, the easy answer to this is that a state says, look, these people took a choice and joined a terror organization. As far as we are concerned, they are not our responsibility anymore. Now, the legalities of this argument could be completely different as well, as Ambassador Fabian also quoted the UK case. So it's a double-edged sword as far as the national security question is concerned. There's no easy answer to it. It ultimately comes down to what a state's policy towards foreign fighters in general is. And if it is ad hoc, if it's a case-to-case basis, then it gives a lot of leverage to the state to decide what kind of action it would like to take towards that particular case.
No, but in a sense, Mr. Taneja, I'm trying to ask the question, if somebody is part of what is seen as a transnational threat, right? That's what international terrorism is. And particularly when you look at groups like the Islamic State, it is it considers itself above nationalities. At that point, people who have pledge themselves to a transnational organization, are they in effect less national, if you like, and therefore can they be barred?
Look, this can be divided into a sort of two-way question, right? Is it legally or is it ethically and morally? I personally believe that they should be allowed to come back and tried as Indian citizens by an Indian court. Because if they have joined an organization such as the Islamic State, which is banned in India, they can be tried as per Indian laws for joining a banned organization. And we saw this happen with someone like Arif Majid, who was brought back by India in 2014-15, went through the trial and is now out on bail because the court said, well, it's been 6-7 years since the case is going. It's very difficult for the prosecution to come up with concrete evidence because of all the acts that were committed were outside India's geography. So after serving 6 to 7 years as under trial, he was given bail because according to the court that he had served his time, so to speak, while this trial was happening.
Right. In fact,
now, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, as I said, you know, so you can argue whether that case was a successful case trying someone who had joined a banned organization like the Islamic State outside, or was that, did that case actually fall out? Despite despite the person spending 6 to 7 years in prison, so it's not easy to answer, right? And because India does not have a cohesive policy towards the very sort of idea of a foreign fighter, because we've not had those many cases, right? So even from the Islamic State case perspective, there are not that many. It's at the moment it's easy for the state to approach them on an ad hoc basis. So in the case of Arif Majid, he was brought back. While these women in Afghanistan are being said, look, you did it by choice and we are not responsible for you anymore.
Right. So certainly there is some kind of contradiction in that response. Ambassador Fabian, do you have any thoughts about this question of people who pledge themselves to a transnational organization versus, giving up their nationality?
Well, let me put it this way. Young people, some of them get brainwashed. Okay, that is how I look at it. And to say that they should be condemned forever just because they got brainwashed, no, that is not the correct approach. Even if these particular young women remain radicalized even now, which again is yet to be proved, we are just assuming. Even if they remain radicalized, we as a state have a duty to get them back and de-radicalize them. And to argue that in Europe, there have been cases where people who are brought back and the state thought they had been radicalized and still they committed something. Well, it's a good argument, but not strong enough. And let me also bring to your notice 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 13.2. Everyone has a right to leave any country, including his own, and to return to his country. Then ICCPR, that is International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, 12.4. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of the right to enter his own country. You see?
Sorry to cut in. May I just ask, doesn't the ISIS example actually merit a different approach? I ask this because, you spoke about the fact that somebody might be brainwashed, somebody might be radicalized. We're talking about people who have taken part in some very, very brutal crimes. The pictures that we saw coming out of the Islamic State, shook the world's soul, people being drowned alive, people being burnt alive, sexual slavery of the Yazidi women, the fact that people were killed indiscriminately there in Raqqa. In fact, actually, there are thousands. It's not just Indian ISIS recruits. In fact, Indian ISIS recruits, which I want to speak about, were perhaps the smallest per capita. But there have been recruits from all over the world. My question really is, when you come to a threat like the one that Islamic State posed at the height of its brutality, is there a case for a different approach?
I think there is a case for a different approach in the sense that we should always stick to legality and morality. And these four women cannot be any threat to India. Let me make that point very clear. About 6,000 left European Union, you see. Whereas from India, how many go there? So if Indian state cannot handle these four people, No, I do not accept that argument. Okay. And let me ask once more a question to you. What happens to that four-year-old girl? And that too in Afghanistan, where there is every likelihood of the Taliban's coming back. The state has a responsibility to its citizens. That is absolutely clear. And the state cannot wash off its responsibility.
Mr. Taneja, you actually have documented so much of the ISIS threat, particularly the ISIS threat in India. Do you think that the ISIS example, the kind of brutality I've been referring to, merits any kind of a difference in approach?
Look, it's very difficult to say that. And let me just, you know, as far as approaches go, if you see the responses of the European countries, for example, I think there has been a slight deviation from you know, how they dealt with, for example, when fighters from Europe in much smaller numbers went and joined the Mujahideen to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, you know, all those years back. But I you know, it's a very difficult question to answer, because legally, maybe unless you have a constitutional or legislative change on foreign fighters and how you deal with your citizens joining you know, these kind of groups abroad, I don't think there's a big option to change per se. I mean, you can't change based on opinion, but if there is a different legislative approach that identifies and defines foreign fighters quite differently than just a normal criminal who has committed an act of terror in India within the Indian borders or within the IPC, you can't really differentiate, right? So, and we have seen that. We've seen countries in Europe struggle with this. Let me just very quickly discuss something called the Al-Hol camp in northern Syria, where a lot of these foreign fighters mm-hmm. are currently holed up, most of them from Europe, because the European countries don't have a legitimized system in place yet to take them back. And of course, it becomes, you know, it's not just a legal question, it's a political question of the host country as well. There is a lot of pushback by society and political sort of dispensations within the countries to not allow these fighters to come back, because they usually, you know, how it used to work, at least in 2014 to 16, during the peak time when a lot of these fighters went, you know, they would land up in these countries, they would surrender their passports, the passports would be destroyed, and then they would quote unquote become the legitimate citizens of the so-called Islamic State, which is not a real state, right? But still, you lose your papers. Mm-hmm. So this a state can say, well, they don't have their passports anymore, we can't prove they're our citizens anymore. And we've seen some of the European countries come out with these arguments, which is why the Al-Hol camp now has like hosts a lot of foreign fighters and has actually become a problematic area, because not just because of the number of refugees there, but because the ideology of the Islamic State still festers, right? So because nothing has been done. So it's what I'm just trying to, you know, say is, like, you know, legalities, morality and all is all fine. But unless there is a legislative change on how you define and deal with people who have gone abroad to fight or join a terror organization such as Islamic State or Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth, it becomes very hard to actually bring them to task once they are back.
In fact, the problem you're referring to is much larger, because take a look at some of the numbers. You know, Frontline PBS documentary actually found 40,000 such fighters who had joined the Islamic State from 81 countries. Those 81 countries included, of course, neighboring Turkey, Tunisia, but also Russia, Saudi Arabia, many European countries, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, France, Germany, Belgium, and all the rest. And each of them, as you said, has been actually quite reluctant to take these fighters back. So my question would be, you know, Mr. Taneja, Ambassador Fabian brought up a point, which is this group of women, and these, we should make the point that they got as far as Afghanistan. They didn't go to Syria. It's a different branch that they were a part of. These represent a very small number. They're about four. In all, in fact, I remember a paper of yours on the influence of ISIS in India. In all, an estimated number of actual Indians who went over, joined ISIS, and either died or came back was, I think, between 100 and 300 was the estimate. So my question to you is, in a different sense, Was India somehow immune to this kind of broad-based radicalization when you compare the numbers per capita to other countries like the ones I just mentioned? And in fact, would there be a case for a de-radicalization program as a result working better in India?
See, that's a very loaded question as well. It's difficult to say because let me take the second part first and talk about the de-radicalization program. There are Indian states that have de-radicalization programs. Right now, I've done research on this. We exactly don't know what the, you know, start to finish blueprint of these programs is. But I would question the final legitimacy of when people come out from this program as quote unquote de-radicalized, you know, because it's very difficult to say. We've seen this in the UK before, that people who have come out of these programs still have committed acts of terror. And even if that happens 1 out of 30, it still becomes very difficult to actually sell these programs as something that should be invested in both politically and security wise to both the people and the political systems. So it's difficult to say. Now, let me just go back very quickly to the Arif Majid case in 2014-15, if I remember correctly. Now, this person was brought back.
He received bail this year in February.
Right, exactly. Now, this person was brought back, but also made into an example of what not to do. So he was used, or his case was used as a counter narrative. So there was a reason why, India actually managed to bring this person back and then said, okay, look, there were multiple stories all across the media that, you know, they treated me shabbily, they treat Indians shabbily, there is racism within the Islamic State, they made me clean toilets, fix Wi-Fis, I never fought, those kind of things. So, you know, that till a certain level was a counter narrative as well. Now, the thing with the Afghan case is, it also becomes a very sort of political thing between states, right? So you, the ISKP has a much different, IS Khorasan in Afghanistan has a much different structure to what the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq had. The Islamic State in Syria and Iraq was a very homogeneous, singular organization. In Afghanistan, it's a hot pot of multiple entities. So ultimately, who did they fight for? How were they radicalized? Who did they talk to even when they were not in Afghanistan but still made their way there? It remains to be ascertained. So if they've managed to do that, if they've not managed to do that, I think that's a very important question here. If they've managed to do that, I think they would have been brought back and gone through the gone through the system. But if they still have doubts of what exactly happened there and so on and so forth, maybe they're a little hesitant to commit to bringing them back and putting them through a trial that may not actually implicate them for being part of the ISKP.
All right. Ambassador Fabian, of course, we have within you the person who arranged what is seen as the world's biggest evacuation program of Indian citizens back from Kuwait during the first Gulf War. So I do want to ask you a little about the role of diplomacy in such cases. How do you decide? I mean, what is the importance of recognizing Indian citizens, ensuring that they A, receive consular service, regardless of, you know, whether they're just escaping from violence or whether they are actually perpetrating the violence. What is the role of diplomacy here?
Well, let me put it, you are talking about, you're not talking about the evacuation. You're talking
about... Well, I'm asking you that what is the importance? Because I was referring to the fact that, of course, you were responsible for the world's largest evacuation of Indian citizens from the Gulf at one point.
Yes, we took a decision. The government of the day took a decision that we shall evacuate all our nationals from Kuwait and Iraq. And we were not going to look into any other matter except their holding the citizenship. That's point number one. Point number two, that since it is relevant, I am mentioning it. We evacuated them without charging them any fee, right, for, you know, the air ticket. This is in contrast with what has happened recently. Now, coming to this particular question, we live, you know, all of us should respect international law. Now, it is absolutely clear that Afghanistan has every right under international law to deport them. You know, these four Indian women and a couple of other people, you know, the numbers have been mentioned in various reports. Right. Now, if Afghanistan has the right to deport, where do they deport them to? They have Indian passports. So, if you respect Afghanistan's right to deport them, it follows that you have to say that India has an obligation to accept them.
All right. And Mr. Taneja, I do want to ask not just about the Indian experience, but the international one, in terms of ISIS recruits in particular, who have been taken back by their countries. Is there a study now on what kind of record they have when they go back to their home countries in terms of whether they carried out any more violence? Are there actually studies of that?
I haven't come across many studies per se, but let me just highlight the fact that a lot of the ISIS recruits that went and joined the group in Syria and Iraq who have gone back to their home countries are largely from Central Asian states. So, right, it's the Central Asian states who have had experience with dealing with returning fighters through the Chechen war, the Bosnian war, and the Afghan war against the Soviets. They have had experience on how to deal with them. Now, exactly what happens, or whether they have integration programs, whether they are tried in Central Asian countries, how it goes, I'm not particularly sure, because there is research, but there is limited research, because it's a recent phenomenon. So in the past one and a half year only, have the Central Asian states started to take back a number of these recruits. I'm sure there are like a few cases here and there for posterity's sake, but majority of the European fighters who came to Syria and Iraq and joined the Islamic State still remain either in Syria and Iraq or in the refugee camps such as El Hol in northern Syria, and have actually not gone back, because there remains a largely unclear method by the European countries on how to deal with them, specifically those people who have no documents anymore, right, and have no paperwork anymore. It was very common back then to, you know, give up your documents on borders of certain countries before you stepped into Syria and Iraq and joined the Islamic State. So you're quote unquote technically, you know, from this one state's perspective, stateless. So they'll say, oh, well, we can't take you back unless you prove that you were actually from XYZ country. So, you know, these are the sort of, there are thousands of these foreign fighters still stuck in these kind of limbos. But Central Asia is one place where they have started taking them back in decent numbers. But what happens later on is still a bit of a gray area.
All right. And finally, if I could ask you, Ambassador Fabian, there is now many more sort of questions about international law over this. As Mr. Taneja pointed out, what if they become stateless citizens? What if they don't have any papers from any country? Is there actually a case for them to be made at the ICJ? France has, in fact, made the opposite, that it wants a law really for responsible citizenship to also be brought about. What is the situation at the ICJ when it comes to bringing back returnees?
Well, I do not know whether ICJ, anyone will go to the ICJ, but talking about statelessness, in the case of Shamima Begum, it is my view that it wouldn't have happened. Such a decision would not have been made if she were not from Bangladesh or another country of that nature. If she were born to white parents, it would not have happened. Secondly, even under the British law, you cannot strip a person of citizenship if, as a consequence of that, that person becomes stateless. So the UK maintained that she can have Bangladeshi citizenship. But Bangladesh has already declared that there is no question of her getting Bangladeshi citizenship because she was born in the United Kingdom. So in other words, UK has violated its own law. I think it is necessary to look at these matters not only in terms of the law, which, you know, always evolving, sometimes behind the reality, also with what is called humanity. If we cannot look at young people who made a big mistake, and if you want to condemn them forever, well, I do not think we are behaving humanely. So it's an inhuman approach, well, which I'm sorry to say is most distressing.
Okay. Mr. Taneja, do you have any thoughts on that? Because, of course, you study the acts of terrorists, and Ambassador Fabian's point is really that even regardless of what they might be accused of, they have to be treated by a state in a humane fashion. Do you think the difference between other crimes and terrorism is something that still needs to be made, or do you think the same laws will apply?
No, I think there should be a differentiation over the graveness of the crime. And of course, there should be differentiation where the crime has been committed and how do you deal with it? Because it's very easy for right now, you know, it's when it comes to foreign fighters, it's not just about the law that comes into play. The security comes into play, the legality comes into play, and politics comes into play, both foreign policy and domestic politics. And it all gets entangled into that. We saw the Shamima Begum case became a whole sort of, an event in itself. And there are thousands of such people like Shamima Begum still stuck in various camps around the Middle East. Now, you know, earlier, of course, when we saw foreign fighters coming in and out of, let's say, the Afghanistan-Pakistan region during the Soviet war, there was not a big crisis at that time because the Arab states would readily take them back because majority of the fighters were coming from a blessing of a political Islam system that you go and you fight for Islam against the Soviets, against the communists. So, you know, at that time, none of these debates were formulated. And we've never had droves of people from foreign lands joining Al-Qaeda, for example, whether it be pre-9/11 or post-9/11. This was sort of the first time where there was a sort of influx specifically from Europe that saw this kind of an event take place. And there was chaos and confusion, both from security point of view, from a political point of view, and a legal point of view. So I think it would be and there are already debates going on now that how do you treat people such as those that we're talking about today, joined Islamic State and now would want to come back and say they've made a mistake and so on and so forth. So I think it's going to take a little time. The problem, of course, is the people who are currently stuck in this rut are facing the brunt of a pushback against both a legal point of view and a security point of view. But there are there are not going to be any easy answers. I still believe, fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of these guys who have made the decision of joining these kind of groups are going to face a lot of pushback from the very states that they've come from.
Sure. And we should make the point that these four women who are in contention in Afghanistan doesn't actually want to charge them at present. Their husbands have died, but these women are accused of certainly propagating the ISIS, the Islamic State ideology. I'm going to have to leave it there, but this has been a very, very interesting parley. It does seem to me that the consensus is that regardless of what happens, Indian citizens must be allowed to come back if they have to hold trial here. But it is necessary that one is cognizant of the risks that brings, as well as what the international thinking of this is. Kabir Taneja, Ambassador KP Fabian, I'd like to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Suhasini.
Thank you, Suhasini.